science enthusiasts. I'm your host, Jason Zukoski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, but you probably know our dogs, Bunsen and Beaker. They're the science dogs on social media. This show takes what's best from their account, the curiosity and fun found there, and swirls it into podcast form. Every week, we're going to take some deep dive into an area of science and look at the research that's going on with our pets. We'll also have an expert guest who will enthrall you with their area of knowledge. This is the Science Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Science Podcast. I'm recording this a little early because our family will be on Vancouver Island exploring the endless beaches and surfing. So we're all really excited for that. In science news, we have an article about squirrels. And it all relates to some things that happened recently that put it on my radar to talk about this article. In pet science, we're going to talk about can dogs tell if you're lying or if you're giving them misinformation. I love this little study. Our expert guest this week is amazing. Her name is Dr. Emily Bray, and we got tagged so many times about the puppy pointing study. And Dr. Emily Bray is the author of the puppy pointing study that was on CNN and all over the place. And she was gracious enough to give us an interview and talk about her work. And it's just adorable. So John Rush, I don't know if John Rush listens to our podcast. We had him on our spaces. He's a former CFL football player. Don't drop snacks on the floor on game day. You don't want to end up with a wide retriever. Okay, on with the show, because there's no time like science time. Okay, this week in science news, we have a really fun article about squirrels. So the article is talking about how squirrels move from treetop to treetop using quote unquote parkour skills. Now, why did this come up? Well, one, we were in the mountains and we were watching squirrels and chipmunks move about the trees and marveling at how quickly their body moves. And two, Adam is a huge fan. We all are, actually. Adam has been watching The Office all summer again when he has some spare time and some downtime. That's his show to watch on Netflix. And there is an episode where Michael and Dwight and Andy are doing parkour, because way back when, that was really popular. So what's really funny for the young kids is they get to see through the fads that happened in the past with what's happening on The Office. So that's why I saw this article and I was like, oh, this is too good to be true. Okay. So this article is actually from a report in August 6th in Science. And the lead author is Nathaniel Hunt, who's a biologist at the University of Nebraska. And Nathaniel was mesmerized by squirrels, just like we were, watching them jump throughout his childhood, watching them run and jump and make calculations. And then he was thinking about, you know, how do they know how bendy a branch is? How do they know how far the gap is? What calculations do they make in their head? And they're moving at an incredible rate of speed sometimes, almost like somebody, if you've watched them do parkour, which is a constant rate of motion moving across the city, either high or low, doing jumps and flips. How do they make that calculation? How are they sensitive to that trade-off of bendy branch versus distance to jump? Okay, two, find out the answer to this. What do you think a group of scientists would do? Would they go to nature and watch the squirrels? Nope, they constructed their own artificial forest obstacle course outside the University of California. And the team used peanuts to get the squirrels to jump the gaps. The team isolated a bunch of different variables. One of the first situations that they had to test was subjects had to learn to first leap from branch to branch of high, low, and medium stiffness. So they were testing how willing the squirrel was to jump from branch to branch based on its bendiness, right? But like, if you think of if you jump from a flimsy branch to a flimsy branch, you're going to fall. You're not going to get the same kind of push off, and it's going to be harder for you to grab. They used high speed cameras to capture the jump. They got 12 squirrels jumping for 96 trials. Now, one of the things they found was the squirrels were jumping early from the bendy branch, so they wanted to jump before they got to the end where it was really, really flimsy, and that increased their distance across. One of the things the team found, which I thought was cool, is the squirrels would always jump early on the bendiest branches because the squirrels kind of knew that if they got to the end, they wouldn't get the same kind of force. But jumping early meant they had a further distance to clear. So the squirrel took the trade-off of jump early, more force to jump further. They found that the bendiness of the branch was 6 times more a factor than the gap the squirrels had to jump. Now, to make things a little bit more difficult for some of the squirrels, they found 5 superstar squirrels and ran them through even more difficult tests. They increased the flexibility of the branches as well as the gap distances. And the squirrels had a little bit of trouble initially. They didn't fall, but they landed a little bit more like Andy doing parkour. So they didn't actually fall off the branch, but it wasn't as perfect. What they found was interesting, though, the squirrels kept making the jump. They kept enticing the squirrels to jump with the peanuts, and the squirrels got better and better and better, and they made better calculations on just how flimsy the branch was, so they could maximize their leap across. So one of the conclusions of the study is that the squirrels probably have a good idea within, you know, a few days, the bendiness of the branches beneath their feet and what kind of force they need to jump the gap. So they learn quickly. And I guess if they don't learn quickly, they might fall and not make it. But then they would have an idea about all of the branches in the forest. Another interesting thing they found is that the squirrels will wall jump to slow themselves down. So if they're coming in hot, like they've jumped across a large gap and they're just flying towards a branch, they will turn their body in midair and kick off a tree or another branch to land on their desired location. And that kickoff or that wall jump slows them down enough that they can catch their landing point. Also, I thought that was pretty amazing. So if you're wondering, the team also wondered this too. While we are mesmerized by squirrels jumping through the treetops above us, very little study has gone into just what calculations they're making. And it's interesting to note that they're making multiple calculations really quickly. The more we know about animals, they don't think like humans, but the calculations they make so rapidly in their brains is pretty amazing. And squirrels are on that list. That's science news for this week. This week in Pet Science, we have an adorable study to talk about. And the tagline is, dogs may be able to tell when humans are deceiving them, according to this new study. So what did this new study do? 2 scientists, Huber and Leonardo and their team, recruited a whole bunch of dogs, 260 of them, actually, of different ages and a whole bunch of different breeds. And they set up a brilliant experiment. The experiment started this way. The dogs were shown 2 buckets, and the dogs couldn't see inside the buckets, but the buckets could hold food, and one of the experimenters, the hider, quote-unquote the hider, always hid the food in one of the containers initially. But in half of the trials, the hider moved the food to the second container before leaving the room. So the dogs got to know that one of the buckets always had the food in it initially, and then sometimes the hider would start to hide the food in the other bucket. Now, how did they separate out if the dogs could tell if you're lying or not? Well, the second person, called the communicator, to start with was in the room, and they would watch the hider hide the treat. And before the dog could go get the treat, the communicator would go, they would look at the dog, look at where the bucket, look at the dog, look at the bucket with the treat and say, what did they have them say again? I've got it here. This is good. This is very good. And of course, the dog got to know that the communicator was telling them where the treat was also. So the dog got to go get the treat. Now, in the second phase, here's where things get interesting and hilarious. The communicator was asked to leave the room and the hider hid the treat. The communicator would come back and pick where the hider was always initially hiding the treat. So the idea was the communicator wasn't lying, the communicator was just misinformed. Now, the other part of this phase was the communicator stayed in the room and saw the hider move the treat, but the communicator said the treat was in the wrong bucket. So what happened with the dogs? More often than not, the dogs just ignored the communicator and went for where they saw the hider put the treat. They're like, what? No. And they were more likely to trust the misinformed communicator. So in the times where the dogs went to the bucket that the communicator was talking about that didn't have the treat, it was statistically significant. The dogs would go to the misinformed communicator's bucket, not the lying communicator. So if the communicator saw where the treat went and the dog saw where the treat went and the communicator was like, is this one the wrong one? And the dogs were like, no, it's not. What's the matter with you? I found that hilarious. What a hilarious and amazing study. So these findings suggest something called a theory of mind. And that explains basically what we're up to. And kids get theory of mind when they're around 4. They can kind of figure out when you're just straight up lying or you're just a well-intentioned lie. Like you didn't know that. And they're like, oh, well, you didn't know that. Okay. All right, but they know you're lying. they seem to understand that. Now, one of the things the study was quick to point out was maybe it would be really interesting to have more of a bond between the communicator and the dog. So some trust was built up. Maybe more trust means the communicator could potentially be more trustworthy. And even though the dog saw the treat go into the wrong in the other bucket, they would believe the communicator more. That's interesting. Another fun finding was that all of the terriers were more often to ignore the suggestion of the communicator and just go for the treat. So this terrier straight up had no patience for either misinformed communicators or lying communicators. So that's another part of this. That's another area that the team is looking forward to working on, is checking to see if there's breed differences. Like if there's just straight up more trusting breeds. I would love to try this with Bunsen and Beaker. I think I'm going to do that. I might post about it. What a fun study, hey? That's Pet Science for this week. Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Science Podcast this week. The Science Podcast is always going to be free to download, but if you want to support the show, there's a couple things you can do. The first one is sign up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/Bunsen Burner. There's multiple tiers of support. We have a ton of fun with the patron group. You get to be on the podcast. You get postcards from Bunsen and Beaker. You get swag. You get early pictures. You get a whole bunch of awesome stuff. So check it out. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. The other way you could support the show is checking out our merch shop. Our merch shop is hilarious. It's got all of these adorable cartoons of Bunsen and Beaker. We keep producing more. I just want to thank the people that have supported the show that way. We're really, really proud of our merch shop because the merch, the clothes, is really high quality. The colors are vibrant, and we come up with some really fun designs all the time. So check it out. That's at BunsenBurnerBMD.com. Thanks, everybody. On to the interview. It's time for Ask an Expert on the Science Podcast, and I am super thrilled to have Dr. Emily Bray, who's a postdoc researcher at the University of Arizona at Canine Companions. Dr. Bray, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited to talk to you because it's not every day we have a scientist that also specializes with dogs. And dogs have paws, so that works perfectly for the pun of the podcast. you're at the University of Arizona. Do you live in Arizona and work in Arizona?
I actually do not.
Okay.
So I'm at the University of Arizona, but I also work at Canine Companions, which is a service dog organization that is nationwide in the U.S., but it's headquartered in Santa Rosa, California. So I actually live in Northern California. I say that I live at the field site because that's where all of the dogs and puppies that I work with are. I am, you know, connected with Arizona and I'm part of the Arizona Canine Cognition Center, but I have actually only been there once.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And the other question, just for intro sake, and I don't know when I need to stop asking this, but I think it's still timely, is I've been asking guests how they're doing with coronavirus. Are you and your family doing okay?
Oh, yeah. So we've been really fortunate. We've stayed healthy and we're fully vaccinated. Yay. So definitely grateful for that. And yeah, I think there's been some silver linings to come out of it. So we have a 22-month-old son, and we've gotten to be home way more than we would have with him throughout all of this. Prior to the pandemic, my husband's actually a researcher at UCLA, which is in Southern California, where he's a mental health researcher. But so basically, he was having to fly there once a week prior to COVID.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, which was a lot. Yeah. So now he's been able to work entirely remotely. So that has actually been really great. With, you know, the flip side being that we've been pretty contained and isolated. You know, our families are both from the East Coast, but, you know, thank goodness for FaceTime and Zoom.
Hopefully this isn't too personal a question. Is your husband going to try to keep that up, or are they gonna, you know, now that things are more open, is he back to flying?
Oh yeah, no, nope. So he's still able to work remotely. I think that's at least as far as I know, that's the plan for the future. Because I think, you know, obviously a lot of people have sort of switched over to remote, and I think it's worked. So you know, obviously he can have his meetings and like coordinate things online and everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So hopefully. We won't have to go back to the commute.
Yeah, there's going to be, we talked about, I'm a high school science teacher. And at the end of the year, mm-hmm. we talked about some of the positives that came out of coronavirus. There's a lot of negatives in education, like mm-hmm. trying to teach kids online, high school, middle school, elementary kids. That's been rough for teachers. But there have been some benefits. There have been some kids that have thrived with the online learning. They've liked the freedom. And it's allowed them to like pursue sports and things like that maybe they didn't already do. So it's not for everybody, but I think there's going to be some folks like maybe your family that has some benefits from some of the restructuring of how we think about work and life.
Yeah, definitely the kind of flexibility that has come out and kind of been tested and worked in some cases.
So. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's talk about you and your research. We got tagged a million times by some of the findings from your research, Bunsen and Beaker's account. and it was so exciting that I was like, okay, who is this person? And then I got a hold of you. And man, just thank you for talking to us. So I know you've done some research with dogs and dogs. Could you talk about some of your research findings? I know you've done more than just the one study that was in, I believe it was on CNN. That's where we got tagged from it. So.
Yeah, of course. Right. So I work with dogs. I actually started out I kind of came about all of this in college because where I went to school at Duke, they had just started the Duke Canine Cognition Center. So I was sort of, you know, intrigued as a lifelong dog owner. I came to college and I was, you know, didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. My parents are actually both veterinarians, so I was always sort of intrigued by that, but I was not sure that I wanted to go into the, you know, the medical side of things. Mm-hmm. And then actually I hadn't really been exposed to the field of psychology, even like, you know, in humans until college. And I just was so fascinated by this, you know, study of the mind. So, you know, obviously what pops to mind is like emotions and feelings, but then there's also our thoughts and our cognition and, you know, basically how we process the information that the world is constantly bombarding us with. And so I got really interested in this in humans. So one of my first classes that I took at Duke, the professor studied visual cognition. And so things like, you know, the agents at the airport that scan your luggage or doctors when they're reading x-rays and you're looking for certain things that jump out at you, right? So like in the case of the airport, like, is there a gun or, you know, something dangerous in
something
the bag?
Something suspicious.
Something suspicious or an x-rays, you know, like, is there a broken bone? Mm. But then the way that our mind processes things, you know, we have all of these shortcuts that are often really helpful to us as humans, but then can kind of lead to problems in certain situations. So for example, they find that, you know, if you're looking for, as an airport agent, you know, you're also not supposed to have like water bottles. So like you find a water bottle, now you're more likely to miss if there's something else in the bag, like a gun or whatever. So it's kind of fascinating. And same with x-rays, right? Like if you find a broken bone, you're kind of like, okay, I'm done. But there might be something else, like even more serious. That
I've heard about this, like something else, like cancer or something on the same x-ray.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Right. So my professor, honestly, I think they study this a lot by having people play video games that sort of you know, mock up these scenarios and just to see like, how do we process it? And then like, can we sort of problem solve? How do we game the system and get around this? And, you know, what are some steps to mitigate that? So anyway, I found that really interesting. And then I also stumbled into this field of evolutionary anthropology, which I had never heard of. But anthropology is basically just the study of humans. And then when you add on the evolutionary piece, it's sort of like, okay, how do we come to be that way? Like, what do other animals look like, especially ones that are, you know, closely related to us? Which of their traits do we share? And you can think about this in a like cognitive framework as well. And so anyway, this all sort of led me, and like I said, there was the Duke Canine Cognition Center. And so it all sort of, you know, converged. I'm like, this is so interesting to look at this, these sorts of questions, and like specifically in dogs, right? Because dogs are amazing. And so I did, I started volunteering there, and I took a class with Brian Hare, who is the director of the Canine Cognition Center, and ended up doing my senior thesis. And so I looked at impulse control in dogs, which, you know, as a dog owner, you probably can think of instances dog.
We gotta work on that with Beaker.
Right. But so I was really interested in kind of differences between dogs, right? Some dogs are obviously really controlled and others not so much. But then also differences between contexts, right? So there might be certain things where, or you know, instances where your dog, you know, like they see a squirrel, they don't care, but like you bring out a steak and they're like, they lose it, right? So, you know, and if there's like these different domains that you can test impulse control in. And so I basically looked at that in pet dogs for my thesis at Duke. But also as part of a project that I was on in undergrad, we went out to Canine Companions for the first time, which is where I now work. But like I said, it's the service dog organization, and they work with Labradors, Golden Retrievers, and Lab Golden Crosses. And they basically train them to help people with disabilities. So for example, if someone's in a wheelchair, the dog can pick up items that they've dropped or turn a light switch on and off. They also train, these are really cool hearing dogs. So that's, you know, a dog that they might pair with someone who's deaf or hard of hearing. And basically it's their job to alert them to key sounds, right? So like the doorbell goes off, they come and nudge them and lead them to the source of the sound, basically. And so we went out to work with these dogs. And basically when they were in training, we cognition tested them, which basically means we played a series of fun games just to see how do they problem solve and, you know, try to get a window into things like that we thought might be important later on in their job. So things like memory, right? Like how well, you know, because they have to learn a bunch of commands and remember them in different contexts. Impulse control, obviously a big one as well. How interested they are in humans and how well they can kind of interpret our attempts to communicate with them. And so that's where I really kind of just became, I was like hooked, right? I was like, this is so interesting. These dogs are so cool. And, you know, even though they're, you know, very amazing, and they've actually all been bred over many generations to have these amazing temperaments and whatever, you still see a lot of individual differences in how they think and problem solve. And so it's really interesting to kind of look into that. So after Duke, I graduated and went to grad school at the University of Pennsylvania in psychology, but I was really focused on kind of this subfield of psychology, which is called animal behavior. And so for my dissertation, I actually worked with guide dogs, which is different than the service dogs. You know, they're paired with a person that is blind, and they so they're paired with someone who's blind and help them basically, you know, navigate their world. And so I had this background in the cognition testing, so, you know, playing these behavioral games. So that's something I was sort of interested in evaluating in the guide dogs as well. But actually, I had this kind of cool experience my first year of grad school. You know, you go to grad school and really the first couple of years, you're kind of just in classes And but during the summers, you have free for research or what, that sort of thing. And so my advisors, who actually had not previously studied dogs, they actually studied vervet monkeys and then baboons in Africa for decades. And they were like, you need to go to Africa and observe animals, you know, out in the wild and really get that experience, you know, not just sticking around in the lab and designing these experiments, but also just going observing behavior and you know, thinking about it that way. So I had the awesome experience of going to the Mara in Kenya.
Whoa.
Where, yeah, they have this long-term hyena field site, spotted hyenas run out of the University of Michigan. And so I got to spend about 2 months living out there, and we would wake up every morning and go to the hyena dens. So the grad student that I was working with was really interested in mothering in hyenas. and so I don't know how many people know this, probably not many, but baby hyena cubs are adorable. when they're born, when they grow up, you know, they're called spotted hyenas, and they have spots, and that's actually how we can tell them apart. It's like your fingerprint. Every hyena's coat is different. The spot pattern is different. But when they are first born, they're totally black, except they have little white eyebrows. And it's like so adorable.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then they hang out in a communal den, mostly, you know, under the ground during the day, but you'll see them kind of pop up. And then at dawn and dusk, mainly the mothers will come and nurse them and, you know, bring them food. So we would hang out at the dens and kind of watch these interactions. Because you can also see the cubs, even at that young age, have dominance ranks. And so there will be one cub. You know, typically the mothers have two cubs, you know, in their litter. And typically one will be dominant. And you can sort of tell by the nursing position that it established. Like there's kind of a preferred nursing position, and that sort of goes to the dominant cub. So anyway, I was just fascinated by this. And I was thinking, you know, about my own study species, which is the domestic dog. And I'm like, what do we know about mothering in dogs? Like, I feel like there's actually not that much research on it, even though, you know, that would be probably easier to study than mothering in hyenas, given that, you know, we live with the dogs. So when I came back, I incorporated that into my dissertation. I was really interested in the mothering style. Mm-hmm. And so basically, we were able to partner with the CNI, which is the guide dog school on the East Coast of the United States. And they have a breeding station, which is basically the dogs that are part of their program whelp their puppies there, which means they give birth to their puppies. And they... it's actually kind of adorable. They whelp into these, they're like those little pools, you know, that you like fill up in your backyard and like play in the summer.
Yeah.
So the puppies are kind of contained for the first 3 weeks. And the mother can basically choose to be in there with the puppies, or she has a larger area, you know, if she needs a break. And so we were able to basically put a camera on them for the first 3 weeks and record their interactions and look at how the mothers were with their puppies. You know, how much were they nursing them, licking and grooming them, choosing to be in there with them versus somewhere else. And then we could look at the maternal style of these individual dogs. And so there are a couple interesting things that came from that. So first, we do see individual differences among the mothers. And so some of that is related to things like breed. So we saw that the Labrador retrievers were more motherly than the German shepherds, for example.
Okay.
And then also something called parity, which refers to like the number of litters they've had before, right? So like basically you can look at a first-time mother versus a mother that's had experience before. And we saw that the first-time mothers were sort of more motherly. And then also litter size plays a role. And this is perhaps not surprising, but basically the dogs who had less puppies were more motherly. And I think part of that is just sort of, you know, the logistics of it. It's just easier to give more attention to the different, you know, to each puppy when you have less of them, and also potentially just overall less exhausting.
Yep.
But even over and above all of these sort of demographic factors that are affecting mothering, we see just individual differences, you know, in how the, just like, because you're this type of mother versus a different individual dog. And so what was interesting is that, and the other thing we did was sort of validate these findings. So we could, you know, observe the mothers, watch back thousands of minutes of video, and basically quantify the behaviors, and then look at if this score that we built, this maternal behavior score that, you know, the dogs fall along a continuum, basically, does that map onto other measures of behavior or, you know, of mothering? So we looked at, for example, the hormones of the mothers. So you can look at something called cortisol,
yep.
Which is, you know, a stress hormone. And you do that by looking at their saliva, actually. So you can put like a little swab in their mouth for about, you know, 30 or 2 minutes probably. And it gets the saliva, and then you can basically extract the cortisol from that. And so what we did is we did a little experiment where we got their saliva just baseline a couple hours after dinner, which is actually harder than it sounds. I know we're all used to, you know, dogs drooling everywhere, but because dinner had already happened, you know, they weren't expecting any food, a lot of their mouths were actually kind of dry. They're just like, what is this? You would think this would be the easiest thing in the world, but we did it. So we got, you know, the baseline. And then what we did was we removed half of their litter for 5 minutes. So we just took the puppies into a room next door. And so this is a, you know, potentially stressful event, but nothing out of the ordinary. Throughout the day, often, you know, when the puppies are little, the staff is taking them and weighing them. So they're used to it, but, you know, it might be a little bit of a stressor. And then basically what we do is 20 minutes after that potential little stressor, we take their saliva again. And this lets us look to see if there's kind of, you know, does that stress hormone, that cortisol peak as
well. Does losing their babies for a bit stress them out?
Exactly. Yes. And so what we find is that you do see like a little peak in cortisol, and the mothers that are more motherly, you know, based on that behavioral score that we give them, are also the mothers that are more stressed out by the like slight separation from half their litter. And they're also actually just more anxious in general. Like if you just look at their baseline saliva before we even did the little experiment, the little manipulation, which was sort of interesting. And also kind of validates our behavioral measure. And so then our big question was, okay, great. You know, we've described mothering. We've, you know, been able to sort of quantify it. We see that it's related to these other measures. But is it associated, like, what does it mean for the puppy? You know, like the, if you have a certain type of mother, and bear in mind, this is like their second week of life. So they're, you know, really early on. Does that have any sort of downstream effects on the puppy's behavior, on their stress hormones, right? Like on whether or not they become a guide dog. And so we were able to look at some of these questions. So basically, we had a little over 20 litters in the study, and then we followed those puppies through into adulthood. And when they're about 18 months, they turned back in, you know, they go out to live with puppy raisers, who are these amazing volunteers that raise them for, you know, the first year and a half of their life. They give them all these socialization experiences. They really try to prepare them for their hopeful, you know, eventual future as a working guide. And then they give them back and they say, okay, like, you know, go enter training. And so at that point, when they turned in, before they entered training, we did this cognition testing with them. And then we also, you know, followed their outcome, and we saw, you know, did they graduate and become a guide dog, or were they, you know, we call them a change of career dog, and did they become, you know, a pet? And what was really interesting is that when you look at the type of maternal style that these puppies experienced, you know, week two of life, it is associated with their later behavior. And it's actually even associated, there is a strong association with whether or not they become a guide dog, which is really cool. And so, and it's a little counterintuitive, the findings. So what we see is that actually the puppies who had the over, like the very motherly mothers, they were more likely to be released from the program and not make it as a guide dog, which is maybe the opposite of what I would have predicted. but if you think about it, I think maybe one explanation, we don't totally know why, but, you know, we like to think about why. And so one explanation might be that, you know, maybe if the, you know, if the mom's always around when you're little, you're not having to sort of deal with the stress of not having her there, and you're not building like the resiliency that might actually be serving you well, like in a working role in the future. It's sort of interesting. And because it was also when we looked at like the connections with the behavior, the dogs that had the mothers that were like, you know, super involved, when we tested them as 18-month-old puppies, they were not as good at the problem-solving task. And they were also sort of more, they kind of displayed more anxious behaviors in one of our sort of temperament tasks. So we put them in a room with these motion-activated cats and we let them explore. And so you can kind of see like, oh, are they interested or are they, you know, wary or cautious? And so basically the association we saw is that if you had a mother who was like always around as a puppy, when we put you in the room as an 18-month-old with the cats, you were like quick to bark at them. and, you know, kind of display these sort of like anxious vocal behaviors. So it's really interesting. And we're actually, some of the work that I'm doing currently as a postdoc at, you know, the University of Arizona and Canine Companions is following up on this maternal style work. So we've now actually, we basically are kind of doing almost a replication study, but in a different population. So, you know, these service dogs as opposed to the guide dogs. And we've enrolled, we just finished data collection. You know, it was going to be a 2-year study thanks to COVID and fires and whatnot. It sort of stretched into a, it took us 3 years to collect our data, but we have 60 litters and about 235 puppies that we're now, you know, in the process of following through. So I'm really excited to see, you know, if what kind of results we see in a different population and if these results replicate. And, you know, we've added, we're looking more at the hormone levels like of the individual puppies, not just the mothers this time. So yeah, stay tuned.
This is so cool because this would translate to, since you're working with Canine Companions, which is a service dog facility, then how the mothers are treating their little bye-byes basically would affect the skill and the ability potentially of that puppy to be a service dog if it's more fearful or not as independent. Am I on the right track?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's what we think. And so it's, you know, an empirical question is, you know, if we, what we found in the guide dogs applies to the service dogs as well. Because you would think that the mothering that you experience, that's going to affect the behavior in the same way. But what's interesting is that behaviorally, like a successful guide dog, that phenotype, right, that what that looks like is different than what a successful service dog looks like, right? And is different than what like a successful bomb detection dog looks like or whatever, you know? So like just because, you know, all working dogs are not equal.
No.
So it'll be interesting to kind of follow through and see, like, we know that, yes, it probably is having an effect, but like, what is the kind of direction of that effect?
Wow.
Based on the population. Yeah.
And you just have to wait. That must be excruciating. You got to let all these little puppies become big dogs and see how their lives are going. So
I know. Yeah. So we keep busy in the meantime, but yeah.
That's cool. Emily, could I ask you about one more of your studies before we move on?
Of course.
Okay, so this is the puppy pointing study.
Yes.
Okay, so I know it's not called the puppy pointing study, but that's what literally all of the publications have dubbed it, is the puppy pointing study. and I actually talked about it on the podcast. I talked about your study on the podcast. And I was just smiling from ear to ear, researching it and going through your study in current biology. Could you talk to us a little bit about that one?
Absolutely. Yes. So that study, what we're looking at, pointing is definitely one of the tasks we use, but we're really interested broadly in, I think I would call it social cognition, right? So like how are our dogs able to understand our attempts to communicate to them? And so we know that adult dogs are really good at this. Honestly, a lot of, you know, the small field of canine cognition, you know, has been going on for a couple decades now. And really, that's sort of the hallmark study in adults, right? That if you hide food and you point to it, they can follow that point and they realize like, oh, you're trying to tell me something, and they can use that cue to be successful in finding the food. And this is just a real, it's probably one of the most robust findings in adult dogs. But that sort of then begs the question of why, like, how is it that adults are doing this? And so one possibility is that they are able to follow our cues because they have quite literally grown up in our houses. They are observing us every day. And so they just have a lot of experience watching us. And over time, you know, that translates into them being able to do this. There's also the possibility, and it's not, you know, necessarily mutually exclusive. Like, obviously that can be, that's happening probably. But there's also this possibility of, well, what if has this, you know, because they've lived with us, but this has literally been going on for thousands of years, has this ability actually evolved in them? And if so, we would expect, you know, even puppies to be good at this, right? That they can kind of, they come out ready to follow these cues. They're biologically prepared to do so. And so to kind of test if that might be the case, luckily for me, you have to work with puppies. So I was like, okay, sign me up. Let's go. So one of the amazing things about working with canine companions is that they, you know, breed dogs for their program. And so all of the puppies live within driving distance of Santa Rosa, California.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then they actually, so the way that the program works is that the puppies are born. So most of them are actually born in the homes of these amazing people that are called volunteer breeder caretakers. Oh. And so they essentially are the caretaker for the mother dogs and the males. But then, you know, when the mother dogs become pregnant, they whelp the puppies in their homes and raise them for those first, you know, 7-8 weeks. And then every puppy in the program comes into the Canine Early Development Center. That's where I work. And, you know, they get a vet check, they get their vaccines, and then they go all over the country to their puppy raisers. So what's really cool is that we have the opportunity to work with those puppies when they're around 8 weeks of age, you know, when they come into the center. And from a, in terms of the study, from a scientific viewpoint, this is really cool because basically we're catching these puppies before they go to live one-on-one with their puppy raisers. So they haven't yet, you know, they've obviously they've been socialized, they've seen humans, they've been in a human home, but up until now, you know, their primary, companions have been their litter mates and their mothers. And so they haven't, you know, had that built that one-on-one connection with a human yet. And they're also just really young, right? Like they've just weaned, they're just starting to become interested in food, which lucky for us, since our tasks involve food, it's actually really difficult to work with them when they are not motivated by food.
I can't imagine having a puppy or dog that's unmotivated by food. And I've heard stories. It's just like so hard to train them or get them to do much of anything.
Yeah. They're just like, nope, often they, if they're not motivated by food, they are motivated by just like love and affection.
Oh, right. Horrible. Yeah. They're puppies. Yeah.
But still that's a little harder, you know, from the experimental context. So they come in to around that time and, you know, they're young, they haven't had a ton of this like human bonding experience. And that's the point where we do our tests with them. And so in this paper, We talk mainly about four different tasks. So like we say, there's the pointing task. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just use, there are these like overturned Solo cups.
Yep.
And we actually tape a kibble into the bottom of each one of them. So they both smell like food, because everyone's always like, well, you know, they are dogs. How do you know that they're not solving your task by just using their nose? So, you know, in science, you have to make sure you have the controls that, you know, rule out these alternate explanations. So we do that so that kind of each option always smells like food, whether the treat that they're going for is actually under it or not. And then the other control, just to speak to that briefly, we have a task that we literally call the odor control task. And it's the exact same setup that we would do in the pointing task. You know, there's the two cups, we slide them out. But then when it comes time for the dog to make the choice, we just don't give them a cue. So it's basically like, okay, go. But like, we are not pointing. We're not.
Oh, they just go. They just choose.
Yeah, they just choose. And literally, we have now tested probably over 800 dogs. That includes the puppies and the adults. And they are at 50%. Like, they don't use their nose in this context.
Without pointing. It's just random.
Without pointing. Yep. They're just at chance. Exactly what you would expect.
Really? Oh, my goodness. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so some of them, you know, they'll like just choose a side, right? Like they'll just go to the left every time. And the way that we do it is we counterbalance the side that the treat is on. So like if we have eight trials, four times it's going to be on the left, four times it's going to be on the right. And it's never on the same side more than two trials in a row, if that makes sense. So mm-hmm. like we don't want to bias them towards one side or the other. Which means that if they get 50%, it's literally at chance they're guessing. But so the interesting thing is if you do the pointing study, so same thing, but now you add in the point and you're pointing to where the food is, they are above chance, even as puppies. So they're at about 70% correct. So, you know, they're not perfect.
Right.
And we see individual differences, right? So some puppies are superstars at this task and they're literally getting 100%.
Really? Little puppies were that close?
Yes.
Oh, that's so cute.
Uh-huh. But then others are like not. Oh. But sorry, what were you going
to
say?
I don't know. It'd be so, because you have to probably, I assume you have a team helping you with this, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I assume you have to tell the team, like, don't get excited when they choose correctly, right? Even though you're so happy for the little puppy. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like that would be a manipulated variable you'd have to control.
Yes.
Is your emotion.
Yes. Totally. I actually have, so one of the studies that I did, I think this ended up being for my master's thesis, was literally that question of how emotion kind of plays into cognition. So we did this task that sort of gets at impulse control. It was like a detour task. And so if you can picture this, you know, all of our equipment's very high tech. So I'm basically standing behind this, imagine like a garment rack with like a clear shower curtain hanging down.
Yeah.
And so I'm behind it with a treat and it's sort of like in a inverted V around me, right? And so the dog basically has to put distance between themselves and the treat that they can see and detour around to get to me. But the kind of fun manipulation is that it matters if I'm calling to them like, puppy here versus puppy here, puppy here. And so what we found was that in pet dogs, you know, if I'm sort of in my monotone voice calling them, they're really good at it. And as soon as I get really excited and that gets them really excited, and we knew that because we counted their rate of tail wagging between the two conditions, you know, it's higher during the excited condition. It's like their problem solving goes out the window. And even if they've just solved it, you know, five times in the like calm condition, all of a sudden they can't solve it anymore.
They're trying to smash through the curtain, or
they're trying to smash through the curtain. Exactly. Yeah, it's so funny. But interestingly, so that's with pet dogs. With the service dogs, who again are sort of bred for this like very calm temperament, they're actually the opposite. So when you call to them, and probably for a different reason, right? So like when you call to them in the like monotone voice, they're slow and not good at it. Probably because they're just like not at the level to even like be in problem solving mode yet, right? Like,
yeah.
And then when you're more excited, then they're actually really good at it. Like they need that like little extra,
It's an it's an urgency, right? Especially if they're like thinking something's wrong with you. Oh, this person needs help.
Yeah, right.
Time to get around the curtain.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. But that's an amazing point that you bring up, that when we do these tasks, and especially because we have different experimenters, we work really hard to keep certain things standardized about it. So, and actually to that point, so we talked about our pointing task, but a different task that we did in the same paper, the social cognition paper, is what we call a human interest task. And we were literally interested in the amount of eye contact that puppies make with us in different situations. And one of the situations is just us talking to them in puppy-directed speech, which is kind of a fancy word for baby talk.
Like sing-songy, high-pitched. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so when we do that, we literally have like a recording of me reciting the script, and you know, we have it memorized so that we can be looking at the puppy. And so we literally have all the experimenters that are going to be doing this, you know, we send them the script, they have to practice, they have to memorize not just the words, but kind of the cadence and try to, you know, that we all sound, you know, we're all in that like high pitched register. So yeah, it's definitely something that we are conscious of and think
that's
about.
So cool. So the puppy pointing study, I know it's not called that. So 70% the puppies were for when you were pointing. And the whole, what does that conclude? That there's some inherent, you know, dog sense with human, like human interaction. They can somehow instinctively know what we're doing.
Yeah. So I think there were two conclusions. So one that, these skills that we know are in adult dogs are also in puppies, right? So it's early emerging, like developmentally, they have this ability really early on before they've even interacted with us that much. I should also mention, if you look at even just the first trial, they are at 70% accurate.
Really?
So it's not
they're
learning over the course of the task. And actually they're not. Like, there's no improvement over the task.
Silly dogs.
If anything, they trend towards getting worse. And I maybe would point to their like attention span.
Right. Yeah.
Potential explanation for that. But the second really cool thing, and this was possible again because we worked with canine companions and we know the pedigrees of all of these dogs. So we know how they are related to one another. Mm-hmm. That allows us to calculate something that we call heritability, which is the percent of variation in the trait of interest. So like in point following ability that can be attributed to genetics. And so we find that in both in point following and in eye contact, in that human interest task, 43% of the variation in the traits are attributable to genetics. So it's this highly heritable skill, which again kind of points to the fact that, yes, this could have been being selected for over the course of domestication, to the point that as puppies, they're already biologically set up to really be receptive to our communication, which is really cool.
I love this so much. I'm just like, it's too bad this is an audio cast, because I'm just smiling from ear to ear. I did read, like, I think somebody interviewed you, Emily, and you said just before we move on, because we only have so much time to chat. I think somebody interviewed you, or maybe another one of your colleagues, and they're like, it was a lot of fun, but also we were working with puppies. And there were days that was quite frustrating. And I was thinking, you know, I get that. Because they'd be pooping and peeing because they're maybe not 100% housebroken.
And, oh, no, 100%. That's like the first thing they do every time they come into the testing room. They're like, yup, here we go.
So, but still, I mean, you got to work with puppies. So there's that too.
I'm not complaining.
And were most of the puppies, just for people who are going to ask, just one last question. Most of the puppies were they Labrador retrievers, like that type, or were they all different breeds?
Yeah. So they were Labs, Goldens, and actually the vast majority of them were crosses between Labs and Goldens.
Okay. Golden Labs or retriever, whatever those are.
Yes. Right. Lab Golden crosses. Yeah.
A bunch of little beakers. Yes, that would be chaotic.
Chaotic, but adorable.
Exactly. Okay. Well, Emily, thank you so much for chatting with that about your studies and your early training. I feel like this would be, if you ever want to come back as a guest, we have so much more to talk about with your science. But we have to move on to some of the other questions we ask our guests. Is that okay?
Of course.
Okay. One of the questions we ask our guests for is a pet story. And since we've been talking about dogs, but it's like you personally, do you have a pet story from your life you could share with us?
I do. And it is, spoiler alert, still about dogs.
That's okay.
So our current dog, Samantha, is actually an exact mix of Bunsen and Beaker. So
Really?
Yeah, she's 50% Golden, 50% Bernese Mountain Dog, which is fun. So I'd say she has like the body and coat of a Golden, but then the coloring of a Berner without the brown. So she's
striking. Can you send me a picture, Emily?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
She's so sweet. Yeah. And she actually, so she just turned 12 and a half on Monday. Oh. she's, you know, we totally give in to her every desire at this point. So, you know, my husband has custom built her steps to get into our bed. And she's also succeeded in, we used to feed her at 6. And I think now, like yesterday, my husband said he fed her at 2:45.
What?
She just like yells at us, you know, and then it gets earlier and earlier. And we're like, oh my God.
Samantha. That's the Bernese Mountain Dog. They're talky about food.
Yes, yes. So anyway, I'm like, pretty soon you're just going to have like 2 breakfasts and like we'll call it a day.
Be like a hobbit.
Yeah. But so I actually have 2 quick stories about her. So one is that she's actually originally my husband's dog, and he 100% credits her with our marriage.
Aww.
So, you know, the age-old trick of catching the canine scientist's attention with your adorable dog. but in all seriousness, we were both in psychology grad school together. And despite having a class, we literally never talked until one of our, you know, classmates had a barbecue and Zach came and brought Samantha. And that was like the first time we talked. Cause obviously I was like, oh, who's that?
Smart.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, we ended up getting married. So, and then my second story is that she helps out with my research as a pilot subject. So whenever I'm like thinking up a new study or trying to think about how to ask a question and try to, you know, navigate the pitfalls before they might happen, you know, in the testing room, I get to try it out on her, which she likes because it almost always involves food. I've talked a lot about my research today with puppies, but we've also become really interested in the other end of the lifespan as well recently. So looking at, you know, cognition as dogs age. And so I'm actually part of the Dog Aging Project. Have you heard about that? Or
You have to refresh my memory.
Sure. Yeah. So the Dog Aging Project is based out of the University of Washington. And it's basically this giant initiative. I think there's currently about 30,000 pet dogs enrolled. And basically anyone with a pet dog can sign them up and then you answer a bunch of questions about them. And I think it's annually because the idea is that we'll sort of track the dogs over time. And the hope is that we can learn all sorts of things about canine aging. But I am really interested in this, the cognitive piece, right? So like how the dog's mind ages. And so we've been working on creating some tasks that hopefully will get rolled out as sort of citizen science tasks. So
cool.
You can sign up and then do the tasks with your dog. So anyway, Sammy is often like a proof of concept where it's like, can old dogs do a certain task? And she's now, you know, 12 and a half, or like, where is she getting tripped up? And so I actually have a pretty adorable video of her doing that impulse control task that we talked about earlier with the transparent barrier. And I'm like behind there with the treat calling her. And she's just like bouncing like she's on a pogo stick for like 1 minute. And we're like, oh my gosh. So it's just funny. But yeah, so that's my pet story.
Hey, that's pretty normal. I mean, when my wife and I are teachers. So when we have a good idea, what we think is a good idea, we run it by our kids and we run it. And especially when they were teenagers, Well, Adam is still a teenager. If we get a, they're pretty honest and brutally so. And then we know maybe we shouldn't fly that in class. So it's, you know, it's good to have a test subject that's close to your family.
Exactly. Yes.
I love that. A colleague of mine has a golden burner cross and his name is Laurent, because she's French Canadian. And Laurent is adorable. He's like, he looks like a burner. So he's got the burner coat and face, but he's gold. He's got the golden smile and the golden coloring. So he's very, very striking.
Oh,
it's just so sweet. It's so cool how those breeds mix together.
Yeah, I love it.
That's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing your pet story.
Sure.
The other question we always ask our guests about is the super fact. And that's something that, you know, when you tell people, it kind of blows their mind a bit. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do.
Yay.
So my super fact is that in dogs, it is possible for litter mates to be half siblings. So as in same mom, same litter, but different sires. So basically, females are receptive and can breed over multiple days. So something that dog breeders can do intentionally, or I guess it could also happen unintentionally, she basically could be bred to multiple dads. And then when the puppies arrive, basically you have to DNA test them. And so sometimes, you know, they're all from one dad, but sometimes they can have different sires. Which is kind of interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
So breeders do that intentionally? Is that so they get like a mixed bag?
I think the idea is you can get more genetic diversity within the single litter. So like literally you're not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I see that for like litter health, right? You could have two sires of the same breed and then you would have, I see.
And then also practically speaking, I think if you have multiple males, the female can breed each day of that peak fertility window. And so it maximizes the likelihood that she actually becomes pregnant in the first place.
Gotcha. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a cool super fact. Thanks for sharing that.
Sure thing.
The last section of the podcast is a fun one. We get to talk to our guests about things that they're passionate about that may be outside their area of research. Sometimes it's not, and that's okay. Guests in the past have talked about their love of cooking or tattoos. I always like talking about Dr. Moya McTeer talked about tattoos. You wanted to talk about a couple things that you're passionate about. And one is how you have had to change maybe your reading habits to listening habits.
Yeah. So I love reading, but I, you know, have been super busy between work and then also, you know, as of 2 years ago now, taking care of a tiny human, which apparently, as it turns out, is a lot of work.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
So it's been hard to find the time to, you know, sit down with a book. But I'm all about multitasking. And so I have become obsessed with audiobooks and podcasts. But basically, you know, it's just perfect for my commute. Or I've also, I started when I put my son to bed, I pop in my AirPods and sit in his room with him as he falls asleep. And then I get to listen to my, you know, latest book or podcast. And it's actually something that actually kind of used to stress me out. And instead now has just become such a like relaxing thing. So,
oh, that's smart.
Yeah.
That commute thing for some people, I have never had to commute more than a half an hour maybe, but I know some people's commutes are much longer than that. So you could definitely get through a podcast episode or, you know, a couple chapters of an audiobook. Yeah.
When I was working at the CNI, we were in Pennsylvania and it was New Jersey. So it was about a 2 hour drive. So I listened to Harry Potter on tape. That was really fun.
Sometimes the audiobooks are really good because they have people do the voices of the characters too, right?
Yes. Yeah, right. It was like in a British accent.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. That's
fun. Yeah.
That's cool. So aside from a certain podcast, which I hope is one of your favorites, is there another podcast you could recommend to people to listen to that you like?
So I really love The Office Ladies.
Oh, I love The Office Ladies too. I listen to it every week.
I know. I'm so sad because I'm all caught up now.
I know. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, no, I love that one. I highly recommend it. And yeah. Obviously this one.
But yeah. I don't like plugging other podcasts on my podcast, but I'll plug The Office Ladies. It is it is fantastic. It is. You learn so much about that show.
You
that
so
a lot of
much. I know.
And I'm learning all of the actors' real names, right?
Yes.
Like Jan is. What's Jan's real name?
Melora.
Melora. Yeah. And I was like, oh no, it's just Jan. But now I'm starting to know all these actors and actresses' real names, and I'm like, oh boy. And even like the. When I watch The Office, I'm like, hey, it's Philipedia. That's,
Philipedia. Yeah. I know. It's so funny. I just remember, too, when I first listened to it, how shocked I was at Angela. Because I'm like, oh, my gosh, she's so bubbly.
Yeah, she's the nicest person ever.
Yeah. I know. Anyway, yeah, I love that one.
Oh, that's great. The other thing you wanted to mention in this section is how you have a passion for mentoring students.
Yes, right. So, like I said, this one is a little bit cheating because it is pretty connected with my work. But I've really enjoyed the mentoring aspect. So ever since I was an undergrad, I became involved with this sort of testing, and it's really, involves teamwork. Basically, when you're testing a dog, you always need at least two people because you have the person that's experimenting and then the person who's handling the dog. But now as a grad student and now as a postdoc, I've had that opportunity to work closely with undergraduates and even some high school students. And it's great because we obviously share similar interests. You know, they come to me because they are interested in science and they're interested in dogs. And then I get to provide them with this hands-on experience that they wouldn't otherwise have. So it's really fun also to see what they go on to do. So like several of them are now in vet school. One of them is training dogs. One of the high school students that I currently work with just got into college. So that's, it was exciting, you know? So, I kind of see it as, I had such a wonderful experience as an undergrad being able to play with puppies and learn about science and get into science that way. And so I see it as a way to kind of pay it forward and work with these students.
That's cool. Good for you. It's kind of like I'm now in my career as a teacher. I take on student teachers, right? And try not to mess them up too much.
I'm sure you don't.
Well, maybe a little bit. They're like, I have a system where kids hand their stuff into boxes based on what class they're in. And I think some of the student teachers are like, that's a little weird because it's just a mishmash of assignments sometimes, but it works for me. So, but I'm sure you have different standards that you implore on your mentor students.
Yeah.
Well, that's great because we only get better in a profession if the people following in our footsteps are just as good or better than us.
Yeah. Well, and the fun thing too is like, as we're doing the studies or whatever, they'll have questions and it's great because it makes me think, sometimes we're like, oh, maybe we should tweak this. Like that doesn't really make sense or like by me having to explain it, I'm like, oh, right. That's why we decided to do it that way. So it keeps me on my toes, but I think also like ultimately improves the research, which is fun.
Yeah. It may not be criticism, but it's just like problem solving together, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Hmm.
So. Yeah. Yeah. It's very different than what you do, but I've had student teachers that are like, hey, why don't we do it? Why are we doing it this way? Or hey, I've got this idea. And I'm like, wow, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. I'm going to steal that. So anyways, yes. Yeah, very cool. All right. We're kind of at the end of the interview. I wish I had more time to talk to you, but I say that all the time to so many guests because their area of research and their area of science is so fascinating. Can people follow you on social media? Is there a website people could find more about your research on?
Yes. So I have a website. It's just www.emilyebray.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Dr. Emily Bray. And well, doctor is like D-R.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. We'll make sure that's in the show notes. So people can just click on the link to your profiles.
Perfect.
Well, this has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And I've been just, as I said, I've been smiling from ear to ear. It's tough not to smile when you're talking about things that the podcast is so centered around, and that's, you know, dogs and pets and things like that, and puppies. I wish you the best in the future. And I always have an open invitation. If in the next couple of years, if you're willing to come back and chat, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I've had a blast.
It's time for Woo or Wow on the Science Podcast. And I have Paula Moses with me today. How are you doing today, Paula?
I'm doing fine, Jason. How are you?
I'm good. And just thank you. You're a patron of Bunsen and Beaker content and the podcast. Where are you calling into the show from?
I'm calling from Connecticut.
Okay. All right. And how did you find out about Bunsen and Beaker?
On Twitter.
On Twitter? Did you see it from a hashtag or another one of our tweets or something?
I'm trying to think. I've been following you for a while. I don't know if it just came up on the feed, you know, like when you hit home and I saw your Bunsen, and I thought, oh my God, a Bernese Mountain Dog, because I'm a dog walker and I used to walk three of them. So I love the breed. And I was like, ooh. So I started following you. I'm like, ooh, this is cool. So then you had all this stuff about science, and then it just snowballed from there because I just got more addicted. So, and I was telling all my friends, gotta watch this account. It's awesome.
Oh, well, thank you. That's awesome. So you're tapped in for Woo or Wow, which is the trivia section of our podcast. And if this is new for people that are just listening to their first episode, Woo or Wow works this way. I read three statements. Two of them are fake. They're woo. And one of them is true. It's a wow. And Paula, you have to find the true statement from the three statements I read.
Okay.
Okay. And the category this week is fish.
Fish.
Okay. All right. Now you can kind of riff as we go, but don't tell me what you think the true statement is till the end. Some guests, I read the first one. They're like, well, that's the true one. Well, I'm like, well, wait, maybe you should listen to the other two.
Okay.
Here we go. Statement one, lungfish can live out of the water for up to a decade. Okay. That's statement one. Statement two, fish cannot raise their body temperature and are locked within the temperature ranges they can survive in water. Okay. Statement three, most fish can't swim backwards. What do you think? Is there one of those standing out as being true or untrue?
I would think three sounds true to me, that they can't swim backwards.
Okay. Do you think a decade for lungfish is a bit long?
Yeah, that's a bit long. But knowing sometimes Mother Nature, that, I don't know, that's really long for a lungfish, unless it's like, I don't know. I don't know much about lungfish. So.
That's okay.
I only know about salmon and the things I eat. But
lungfish either. So
no, I don't know. They must be puffy, I would think, but I'm not sure. But the fish cannot raise body temp. I don't know. I would find maybe they can, but I don't know. I know one time we lost our power and it was winter and they had fish tanks and they all froze and the fish died because they didn't, you know, they couldn't stand, you know, they can't go under freezing water. So, yeah. But the water has to be moving, I would think. But I don't know that it's either two or three, and I'm really undecided, but I'm going to say three, that most fish can't swim backwards is a true statement. But
okay. All right. So the final answer.
I'm sorry.
Is that your final answer? Like final answer? Are you?
Oh,
like,
yes. Final answer is okay. Number three.
Dun-dun-dun-dun. Okay.
Oh, Brad. I knew it.
So no, just final answer. I'm just locking you in. That's the lock-in sound.
Oh, that's the lock-in sound. Oh, I thought I failed.
No. Let's take a look at the first statement about the lungfish. You felt that one was fishy. I thought that one was not quite correct. You're right. A decade is way too long. Lungfish are amazing. They can stay out of water for up to 2 years. They secrete a mucus cocoon and they burrow themselves in the earth. But a decade is way too long. So you're right. That one was fake. So now we're down to the last two statements, the body temperature one and swimming backwards. Which one do you want to hear first?
Oh, you might as well go with the fish can't raise the body temp.
Okay. So this one is false, you win because you would have picked the third one, right? So if this one turns out to not be correct, then you win because you picked the third one to be true.
Oh,
so,
well, that's cool.
Oh, well, you don't know yet. I'm just saying.
Sorry, I'm so confused.
No, it's okay.
I'm getting the wrong signals here, and I'm like, oh, wow, I won. And then you're like, no, not yet. I'm like, okay, maybe I spoke too soon. All right, sorry.
Okay, so fish cannot raise their body temperature and are locked within the temperature ranges they can survive in. That one is not true. Some fish can raise their body temperature. The main one that we think about is sharks. Sharks can raise their body temperature to hunt in colder water. So you win because the third statement is true. Most fish can't swim backwards. The only ones that can are eels and some other really random chance fish. So you win.
Oh, cool. Well, I would think if a dolphin, is that considered, that's a mammal. That's not really a fish.
Yeah, that's a mammal. Yeah, right. But the sharks are fish.
They can swim backwards, but they can flip backwards. But I was thinking that's not a fish, so.
Yeah, they're kind of not designed to go straight backwards. They're kind of designed to go very quick.
Yeah, right. If you look at a fish tank, they always turn. So, that you know.
Oh, smart. Right? Yeah, I never thought of that as you could puzzle that one out. Well, congratulations. Your first time on We're WoW when you win.
There's a woo from me.
I appreciate you taking the time to do We're WoW today, Paula. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jason. It was my pleasure, and thanks for having me as a guest.
Okay. You have yourself a great day.
You too now. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for story time with me, Adam. If you don't know what story time is when we talk about stories that have happened within the past 1 or 2 weeks. But this is a very special story time because we are in Tofino. We are on vacation. We will talk about stories that have happened on the vacation. Okay, I will start. So it takes a long time to get to Tofino from where we live. So we are in a car for about a total of, like, I don't know, 17 hours. That whole time I was on beaker watch duty. And because she has hot spots and she keeps on biting and licking herself, and it's not very great because they look kind of gross when you look at them. Anyway, I was on beaker watch duty. Every once in a while, I would have to put her cone on, and then every once in a while, I would take it back off because she would be sitting like really close to me and really being really cute and trying to get me to take it off. It worked from time to time, but then sometimes she would immediately do it as soon as I put it on, and that got kind of annoying, so I did not take it off then. Anyway, second part to my story is they would take turns getting on my lap. Like, Beaker would just crawl up onto my lap for no reason. I don't know why, but she got comfortable and then lay down and then fell asleep. But Bunsen did that once. I think he was going crazy. He was going insane from being in the car for so long. He tried to jump out the window while the window was closed. So yeah, that happened. Bunsen crawled on my lap and tried to jump out the window when the window was closed. But Bunsen was a very good traveling dog. He just like sat down or laid down. And sometimes he would want snuggles and pets. And sometimes he would just go to sleep. So that was Bunsen. Beaker was a little bit different. She would chase the light that reflects off of your phone in the car. So a little bit less of a traveling dog, but Beaker was still pretty good. That's my story. Mom, do you have a story?
I sure do. So we've arrived in Tofino and we have gone to the very first beach just, you know, to check it out. And Bunsen, it's like, huh, wait a second. I remember this. This feels like home. And he just like spread out his front paws in the sand, and then he started. It was similar to when you wiggle your toes in the sand. That's what Bunsen was doing, or that's what I liken it to. And then he decided, oh yes, I can get really good purchase here in this sand. It was kind of hard, kind of wet, not the floofy sand. And he planted, and then it was like he was a bull. He was like not snorting and not angry in a rage like a bull, but he would pull back in the sand and then charge a beaker because he wanted to play. And so he was trying to play, and you can actually see it in some of the drone footage. Him just kind of on guard, charge. But what happened was I said, no, Bunsen, we're not going to do that. We're not going to chase Beaker. We're not going to jump on Beaker because Beaker's always game. She's like, oh, yes, 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 let's play, let's play. So he looked at me, he went, huh? And then he started to bite his leash. And it was like he was playing with me. He was playing pull tug on his leash. And he only does that very, very rarely. Jason actually hasn't seen him do it in a very long time. But it was like he was a little bit, kind of a rude word, but a little bit pissy, sadly. But then he gets out of it right away and he's like, okay, I'm happy dog. So that's my story.
Oh, Beaker. Dad, do you have a story?
We took Beaker down to the ocean with Bunsen, and the last time we were here, Beaker was a puppy. I don't know how much he remembers, but Bunsen doesn't like to get much more than his paws wet. He likes getting his paws wet. He likes that. I think it cools him down. We were walking, and the tide was coming back in, and we were walking through water that was probably only up to their paws, and then we hit like a shelf, so it got really shallow, and then it got crazy deep, and we were stuck in the middle of it. And unbeknownst to Bunsen, the water was getting deeper and deeper, and it was up to his knees, and then it was up to his chest, and he was not wanting, he didn't know what to do. He was confusing because we were walking away from the ocean, but it was getting deeper. So he was doing this weird gallop jump so he could get out of the water, and then that just got him in deeper. And then he was sad, and he planted, and he didn't want to move. He was kind of upset that he was so wet. But we got him out, and then he was a little dejected. So his burner fur around his legs was, like, wet and plastered on him, so he had, like, skinny legs compared to his fluff. So he looked like a bodybuilder that has skipped leg day. That's my story.
I was walking with Bunsen at that time, and it was like he was calculating. How am I going to get out of this? And then it was the cutest jump that I've ever seen. But definitely he will not win high jump in the Olympics.
So that's story time. Story time on vacation. Hope to see you guys next time on the podcast. Bye-bye.
That's it for this week's podcast episode. Thanks for coming back week after week to listen to us. Special thanks to Dr. Emily Bray, who talked to us about puppies. This is such a good chat. She's so enthusiastic. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our top tier patrons on Patreon. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. Take it away, Chris.
Samantha Dodd, Kimberly Bond, Nate Stevenson, Debbie Anderson, Courtney Proven, Renee Hardy, Mary Rader, Shelby Leggett, Dan Bry, Mary Coos, Katla Lynch, Marianne McNally, Andrea Persons, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Bianca Hyde, Lynn Armstrong, Lisa Swartz, Catherine Jordan, Donna Craig, Lila Ashier, Jody Ogren, Liz Button, Kathy Zerker, and Ben Rathert.
Let's close with the dog's motto: for science, empathy, and cuteness.